What I thought I'd actually do is just relay to you something that happened earlier in this week. I have been plowing my way through Winston Churchill's History of English Speaking Peoples, and I've actually finished chapter, not chapter one, but book one. There are four volumes altogether. Volume one I've actually finished this last week. I've read a few books between the actual chapters that I've been going through. But it was about Richard III. Now, Richard III, if you listen to Shakespeare and various others, was not a particularly nice fellow. And his life, what in fact happened was the previous king died very soon, very suddenly, and he was the protector of the princes, the two princes. He basically got them locked in the tower, and he then took the throne for himself. And the people of England, however, the word got around to the people of England that this was going on, and they weren't too happy about it. And he also saw these princes as a threat. So, by all accounts, it looks like he had them murdered. And they've actually, I think, around 1600, this is about 1450, 1470, something like that. And around 1600 and something, they found two skeletons in the tower, and they had them reburied. And I think they've actually done some forensic work on them since, and they've actually have confirmed that they were, in fact, like these two princes that had been murdered and been buried in the tower. But in commenting about this particular individual, because obviously the things that were going on at the time, there was a quote, and what in fact is valuable about Winston Churchill's History of the English-Speaking People is not so much the actual history itself, because it tends to be, you know, one battle and one bloody gory bit after another, just about. But when you go through it, there are certain little gems that leap out that have pertinence to today. And this was one of them that hit me this last week. I'd just like to read you some of the comment that he had. He said, "Although accustomed to the brutalities of the long civil wars, the English people of those days still retained the faculty of horror, and once it was excited, they did not soon forget." He goes on, he says, in the 15th century, the murder of the two young princes by the very man who had undertaken to protect them was regarded as an atrocious crime, never to be forgotten or forgiven. In other words, the people themselves remembered that. But the interesting snippet was that he said this. He said, "But a modern dictator, with the resources of science at his disposal, can easily lead the public on from day to day, destroying all persistency of thought and aim, so that memory is blurred by the multiplicity of daily news, and the judgment baffled by its perversion." Now, I thought that was a classic one, like really. That, and you know, let me read again. "A modern dictator with the resources of science at his disposal, TV, the media, the news gathering, all this kind of stuff, can easily lead the public on from day to day because they're constantly dripping some information through to all the public." You see, that didn't happen in years ago, but today that's exactly what happens. "Destroying all persistency of thought and aim." And you look at the media, look at the way the sound bites are organized, you look at the way in which computer games are organized, everything has got to be instantaneous. Even the various tests that you have within the school systems, it's all tick boxes and that kind of thing. There's no, not the kind of logical thinking that is there. So it destroys all persistency of thought and aim, so that the memory is blurred by the multiplicity, by the amount of the stuff that is coming through. The memory of what went before gets erased because, you know, you can't take it all in, of the daily news, and the judgment is baffled by its perversion. By constantly giving a twist here and a twist there, you're constantly feeding people a lie, and you can feed people a lie to a great degree today that you couldn't do years ago. And I thought that was very interesting. I'd like to read you part of an email that we received. Well, we didn't actually receive it. We were given it in printed form from Brian Hancock, who'd received it from somebody who knew somebody who was actually in the tsunami. And this is coming from an eyewitness account, somebody who was actually there, who witnessed what was going on and witnessed the aftermath as well. And just to give you an idea of what, in fact, when we read the news, the kind of things we've got to be looking out for. So it's a small Muslim gypsy fishing village on the beaches of Koh Lanta lost their homes and the boat in the wave. The government refused them permission to rebuild their homes, providing them with a small amount of land, 1,000 meters inland to live. You can't have a fishing village 1,000 meters inland. Fishermen that had lived by the sea for generations now forced to abandon their livelihood. Why? So the government can sell the land to the tourist developers. When I was there 2 weeks ago, they were desperately trying to rebuild their homes as soon as possible without permission, hoping to create a harder task for the government to kick them out. Now this is going on now, and this is the story that you don't necessarily see. You might see it occasionally in little snippets here and there, and this is why in the news is the snippet here and there is so valuable. There were a couple of foreigners dedicated to assisting these villagers, buying sheet metal, tools and timber, spending every day with these people, building with them. We helped out and translated for a photojournalist before having to move on. Excuse me. Occasionally, throughout the day, Thais in business attire would stroll through the frenzy of building along the beach to inspect the land and business opportunities. Sour glares directed at my friends helping a gypsy maker nail a wall. There were hundreds of similar villages. A friend of a friend is helping a village near Kowalak. The military bring a helicopter in their mountain refuge, 3 kilometers inland from the beachfront village. Out come the TV crews, filming the soldiers, delivering a 50-kilogram bag of white rice, then back to the chopper and out of there. These people didn't have fresh water to cook the rice, let alone saucepans and cookers. But the real story doesn't matter, apparently. So yeah, they drop the rice, it's on the media. You see that? Aren't they doing a wonderful job? But in fact, the reality is totally the opposite. Another helicopter, another film crew, this time a makeshift hospital, days after the tsunami. My friend is helping the hospital. He sees the chopper, the soldiers, the film crew. They handpick 2 good-looking nurses and rehearse the giving of fresh water bottles, smiles on their faces. My friend walks over and spits in the soldier's face. Look around, he says, people dying. We don't even need fresh water here. So it looks like everything is okay on the TV screen. Must mean everybody is doing their best. Everyone is doing what they can. Excuse me while I take the TV and throw it out of the window. The situation is terrible. Government manipulation and exploitation is the game, and it ain't over until they have everything that they can. This is not just Thailand. I remind you that the Australian media published articles misquoting me and sensationalizing my account to the point where they changed, quote, I got back to my beach and everyone was okay, to, quote, he returned to the beach to find everybody dead. Be critical of the media or turn off the TV. Vested interests are rife. Why would they do that? Why would they go ahead and change, oh, I got back to the beach and everyone was okay, to, I got back to the beach and everyone was dead? Because the angle that they were using was everybody died in this particular area. And the truth didn't matter. As I've said before, I have witnessed somebody pushing down throwing a piece of a artifact from one place to another because it didn't fit their particular theory on an archaeological dig. And this doesn't, you know, it doesn't stop now. And really, as we find, you know, what Winston Churchill said here, that a modern dictator with the resources of science, because they've got the film crew, and they can take a reality which they have twisted and they've warped, and they then multiply it, and they send it out to all and sundry across the world, you know, billions of times, the actual what is happening is actually twisted. It is not true. It's a lie. And the father of lies just loves that kind of thing. Now, we need to be aware that something is going on. I mean, what is happening at the moment within this new terror law that they're pushing through? It just seems incredible that they are pushing this through, and they're trying to get their way, regardless of need. It's not the need. And it goes into the ID cards as well. It says, in the one from Friday, 11th of March, it says, Labour's bad impression. The government has built its flimsy case for the implementation of a compulsory ID card system upon the fear of terrorism and a related epidemic of identity theft. It's not surprising, therefore, that private business has sought to move in on that territory. A credit card called Capital One paid the talented television impressionist Alison McGowan to appear in advertisements and so on. And then what happened is a journalist then went, and they were warning people about identity theft and how to avoid it. So a journalist went into the refuse of this particular television personality, found an actual active credit card in the refuse, and then showed how easy it is to use it. But an ID card is not going to stop that. It just isn't going to stop that at all. It another one here from last yesterday. It says the two Blairs are pulling the wool over our eyes. It says the contradiction over the new anti-terrorism legislation was never so starkly put as it was yesterday by the two Blairs, Tony Blair and Sir Ian Blair, the new Metropolitan Police Commissioner. Just as Sir Ian was talking about the grave threat to national security that would be prevented by the new legislation, Tony Blair was releasing some of the foreign terrorist suspects on bail. Both Tony and Sir Ian tried to give the impression that for the new legislation, national security would be threatened. That is just untrue. And Sir Ian is simply wrong when he said that suspects will walk free on Monday if the new legislation isn't passed. Again, what's the real reason behind it? I can't, get up here and give you the real reason behind all of this. I don't know what the real reason is. But I do know this, that we need to be very aware that what we see on the surface is not going to be the real reason. And you need to therefore look at things in a much more critical way when we read the newspaper. If we turn over to Isaiah chapter 5, Isaiah chapter 5. It's the way in which we read the reports coming through that we really do need to be aware of. Isaiah chapter 5, be aware of this scripture. It says in verse 13, it says, Therefore my people have gone into captivity, because they have no knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude are dried up with thirst. They've got no spirit there. There's nothing, not even the human spirit of any substance that they used to have before. And verse 20, it says, Woe unto them that call evil good, and good evil, that put darkness for light, and light for darkness, bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter, and they are wise in their own eyes, and prudent in their own sight, and mighty to drink wine, and so on. But the problem is that it is all their own ideas, their own concepts, and they will manipulate it for their own advantage. They do not fear a higher authority, and it's the higher authority that gave this land and America and the English-speaking peoples the strength that was there at one time and that today just simply is not there. Now, you can see it quite clearly when you look at this dripping of moral corruption. I can't really read all of these particular articles. But if, give you an example, this one from the 10th, Thursday, 2 days ago. Schoolgirls match boys for weekly drinking. Schoolgirls have matched the drinking habits of boys for the first time, government statistics show. The annual survey found that there's now little difference between the sexes in the amount of alcohol drunk a week. And it goes down, it says, Drunkenness has not just become acceptable among young women, it's now seen as desirable and even necessary for a good evening out. The marketing of booze-based lifestyles by the drinks industry and through the media has undoubtedly fed this and a more sustained effort to reduce underage drinking and to get a grip of alcohol education in schools is urgently required by the government. One thing I found out yesterday, which I thought was most interesting in this light, is that in many clubs over here, they will actually give free drinks for girls. And that, to me, is astounding, absolutely astounding. But they know that if they give free drinks for girls, the girls will go there, and the boys will therefore follow. And the boys therefore will buy, and they'll probably buy for the girls as well if necessary. But that apparently is the way it is. But we see this, what we're seeing though is we're seeing a steady drip. I mean, the idea of a drunken woman 30, 40 years ago, I mean, it was abhorrent. She, I mean, you know, the gin, the ones that used to be on the gin, I mean, that was the... That was, it was looked down on in an incredible degree. But as it says here, it's almost not just looked down on, it's actually not just become acceptable, it now seems as desirable and even necessary. Another one, BBC will not bow to the religious extremists. Mark Thompson, the BBC Director General, has warned against the growing power of extremist religious groups after the campaign against last month's broadcast of Jerry Springer the Opera. Now again, is it extremism? Today it's looked upon as extremism to object to putting Jesus Christ in a nappy and saying that he's gay. I mean, that's looked upon as extremism. And even the word gay is a twisted word. It's sad. that's what the word should have been. Another one, that was back on Wednesday this week, call to end ban on affairs between officers and ranks. A former commanding officer of the Women's Royal Army Corps will call today for the ban on sexual relations between officers and other ranks to end. Dr. Diane Henderson, who is now an academic at Queen's College, Cambridge, says the number of women serving in the army makes the ban impractical, outdated, and possibly illegal. And on it goes. So again, remember, these are this last week's paper. Another one, Howard warns of a sex disease epidemic. Britain faces an epidemic of sexually transmitted disease, Michael Howard said yesterday. And the Tory leader said that if he won the election, his party would launch a publicity blitz modelled on the 1980s AIDS campaign to warn of the dangers of sexually transmitted infections. Tony Blair may not think sexual health is a national priority, but I do. And all he's doing is he's actually making it an election issue. But it's a steady drip. It's another dripping of this. Another one, and this is from yesterday's paper, The Naked Truth. It's been pilloried as porn, but Michael Winterbotham's sexual odyssey is a frank and funny triumph. And it goes on, it says, Nine Songs is less a film and more a pub dare. You can just imagine director Michael Winterbottom and his producer knocking back a few pints and laughing about the ideas of making a new kind of romantic film. And it goes on, it says, The result is, as almost always the case when Winterbottom ditches big names actors, is brilliant. Sure, it's porn, it could be used as such, but at least, unlike most of the sleazy stuff on late night Channel 5 or the deliberately mislabeled videos in most people's homes, it doesn't feature any Kenny G style saxophony on the soundtrack. Most importantly, it's funny, true, and emotionally overwhelming. So it's acceptable. Now that, again, this last week, the same kind of thing, and remember, what did he say? What did Mr. Winston Churchill say? He said, a modern dictator, with the resources of science at his disposal, can easily lead the public on from day to day. Now you say a dictator? Well, he's not a dictator. No, you don't have to have a dictator as such. You can have somebody who, or something, or a certain movement, a certain direction, and the one who is behind it is a certain way. Destroying all persistency of thought and aim so that memory is blurred by the multiplicity of daily news. It is this constant bombardment, judgment baffled by its perversion. The twisting is here, it is there. Another one, the bleak outlook for marriage. Now, which one was this? Is this yesterday's again, I think? It was very, within the last few days. The number of married men and women will fall below 50% of the population for the first time within 6 years, according to a government forecast published yesterday. Now that includes married people who are married for the second, third, fourth, fifth time. They're counted as married, but it will actually fall below 50%. So again, you're looking at this constant drip of this morality. Another one from yesterday's, Clint helps Amanda to strike a blow for the ladies. The success of the Oscar-winning film Million Dollar Baby has helped a British female boxer to make history, and for the first time in its 116-year existence, the English Amateur Boxing Association's final night will include a woman's bout. An England star fighter, Amanda Coulson, 22, from Hartlepool, who boxes at light welterweight, will face Ireland's Alina Murphy and so on. And it again is accepted. And this morality is being drip-fed. And each one of these, as I said, is from this past week alone. And finally, this is from a week ago. The church remains at risk of schism on homosexuality, warns Williams. The prospect of resolving the deadlock looked bleak, however, after the Right Reverend Frank Griswold, the liberal presiding bishop of the American Episcopal Church, indicated they had no intentions of shifting. I cannot imagine a conversation saying we got it wrong, said Bishop Griswold after the meeting. What's he say? It says Richard Kirker, General Secretary of the Lesbian and Gay Christian Movement, said the church would be torn apart if he didn't rethink its position on homosexuality, and on and on and on it goes. The morality of the country is changing, and this morality is being drip-fed. It's being pushed through. There is an agenda there. The agenda may not be known by the people actually doing it, but the one who's out to destroy us morally is Satan himself, and there is an agenda there. As we read the news, as we listen to the television, as we see these things developing, we've got to be aware that this is the case. Many times, remember what it said, again coming back to what Winston Churchill said, it says that memory is blurred by the multiplicity of daily news. In other words, you forget about things that have gone before. Now, two things that I noticed in the papers over this past week. One was from yesterday, the HIV immunity from mutation that beat the plague. Interesting. A person living beside the Tigris 3,000 years ago may have helped to make 10% of modern-day Europeans safe from HIV, scientists said yesterday. The unknown Mesopotamian was born with a mutation that made him or her resistant to deadly viral infections. Over the millennia, descendants of this evolutionary pioneer spread out through Europe and ultimately into North Africa. Again, the evolution aspect is being drip-fed. You find it in virtually every aspect of that you read. And it says, each of them carried the same mutation, CCR5 Delta 32, give it a nice long name. And was this able to survive the catastrophic, to survive the catastrophic plagues of the Middle Ages? The fortunate blip worked and still works by locking out viral infections as they try to enter white blood cells via a chemical gateway. And wasn't that wonderful? How this pure mutation allowed people to survive the plague back in medieval times, but also today, HIV. That's the way to do it, because we've got this wonderful mutated gene, and that's the answer. You see, again, as it says, multiplicity of news clouds the memory. What was it that actually helped as far as the plague was concerned? Which quarter of all the quarters was exempt from that plague? It was the Jewish quarter. The hygiene laws protected the area. And they thought, therefore, that they must have been given the plague, so they massacred them instead. And who is it, in fact, that escapes from the HIV plague? Well, people that are monogamous, that have a single partner and stick to that partner. Not just partner, but wife or husband, and have the morals necessary to be there. So again, you can read over the top, and you can read things like this, and you can then, we can then be bamboozled by it all. Another one that I read, again, going back to Friday again, just yesterday. The British success heralds gene therapy revolution. Bubble boy Mustafa's immune system rebuilt after a transplant. It goes on about a hereditary disease, and this transplant allowed this person, this little boy who was living in a bubble, to therefore go ahead and have freedom of movement. It was literally a few weeks ago, there was an article in the paper that gave examples of these type of children who would be having to live in a bubble. Maybe there was a different syndrome, maybe it was a different gene, maybe it was different whatever. But within this area, they were living in a bubble, they're having to live in a bubble, and they therefore had this therapy 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, and now they're developing leukemia. Nothing is mentioned here about that. But what is mentioned is that the UK research is tied up in red tape. You see, the angle that the research on human embryo and all the rest of it being tied up in red tape, trying to influence the government to get rid of that red tape so they can do human embryo research and re-experiments, that's all being pushed. So I thought I'd just take these few minutes, therefore, to just remind us that we are being drip-fed. Another one in, that's last Saturday's. Pro-lifers push Mississippi to the brink of becoming the first abortion-free state in the USA. Outside the last abortion clinic in Mississippi, Melody Miller feels the triumph is within her grasp, and it goes and gives this very biased account. It says, according to Mrs. Thompson, poor black women living in the Mississippi Delta already have little choice but to give birth or rely on the services of backstreet abortionists. All pro-abortion, anti this so-called life movement, the needs of the unborn, the fact that there is an individual there, is not even dealt with in any way. So these things need to be kept in mind as we listen and as we look at the news, and we need to make just as you do listen to the news, and particularly as you listen to the television news, as you do that, just keep in mind what I've said and what I brought out today, and particularly that piece from Winston Churchill, which I thought was very, very good, that a modern dictator with the resources of science at his disposal can easily lead the public on from day to day, destroying all persistency of thought and aim so that the memory is blurred by the multiplicity of daily news and judgment is baffled by its perversion. I thought that was very good, and it certainly struck a note.